At Her Spirit, we're here for you. We want to help you discover your potential, achieve your goals, ignite your fitness, find your community. Head to herspirit.co.uk and sign up for our core membership. Get access to our virtual classes, monthly challenges, expert advice, and track your progress in our health hub. You'll also find your very own cheerleading squad who will support you every step of the way. Use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 and get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Hello, a very good morning again. Welcome to the Her Spirit podcast. And I say very good morning because it is morning time. And Annie and I think we're both a little bit emotional this morning. What have we been doing, Annie? Not in the same place, but go on.
Oh my gosh, we've been watching the lovely Sir Tom. I'm going to call him Sir Tom because I reckon he's up for a knighthood. The lovely war veteran. I mean, I was just sitting on the sofa and kind of, I had to sort of like turn away from my children because they think I'm weird because I cry at anything. I mean, how could you not be emotional watching that?
So this was Captain Tom Moore, who's nearly 100, doing the 100th lap of his garden to raise money for NHS charities. And this has been a story we've been watching or following on BBC Breakfast for nearly a week. And it's just been mind-blowing, hasn't it? I did kind of know yesterday that he was going to be live on Breakfast, but I hadn't really sort of like mentally got my head around it. And then I turned on the telly this morning and there it was happening. And there's just this kind of outpouring of emotion, isn't it? It just, yeah, I don't cry much, Annie, and I definitely had tears in my eyes this morning. It's something very special going on.
So special. And I just wonder what lovely Tom is thinking when he wakes up in the morning. I mean, it was only, what was it, a week and a half ago or something. He thought, oh, I've raised £1,000 for, you know, for the NHS. And now there he is on national TV.
And what is it? We're into our fourth week of Let's Call It Lockdown. And didn't we need some good news?
Oh, we really did, didn't we? I know I'm not going stir crazy yet, but I'm just, yeah, I think everyone's getting slightly like, okay, when is this over? We feel like we've done the hard yards, but it seems like there's a little while to go. So we've got to keep the hatches battened down and just kind of roll with it, I think.
And what we have, of course, is a wonderful guest. So if you're planning on going out for a walk, I don't know, whatever, you're doing gardening, you need some company, you need to listen to our next guest, who is absolutely brilliant.
Oh wow, I don't think they come bigger than the athlete you're about to mention, Lou. I mean, absolutely incredible and just so understated. When you look through her resume, you just go, how is this possible that one woman alone has achieved all these results?
Well, listen, I'm going to give you a few of her numbers before we introduce her. So she has, and she may have to correct me on this because we've been adding them up all morning or trying to get it right from various different sources. So 38 world titles, 5 swimming Paralympic medals, 9 cycling gold medals, Paralympic gold medals. And she is, I mean, you just can't even believe that, can you? Dame Sarah Story, you are a machine. How lovely to speak to you.
Thank you very much, Louise and Annie. It's great to be here.
First question, I mean, where do you put all those trophies and all those medals? I can see you. I think, I'm not sure where you are. Explain to us where you are. I can see at least one trophy behind you.
So I'm in our office at home. My dad has got most of my medals. I've got World Champs medals in the cupboards upstairs, usually wrapped up together in a plastic bag so that I've got each of the medals with the right jersey. And I've not put them all in one place. So I probably should be more organised. And here's some of the trophies that I've won in different events across the last few years, I suppose.
Is there a special one or not?
No, I think obviously the Paralympic Games is the event that you build up for every 4 or 5 years, as it is at the moment. So, yeah, it's one of those where you're trying to build every 4 years towards that big, big goal, and everything else in between is a stepping stone towards the Paralympic Games.
And in total, just to summarise, you do have
14 gold, 8 silver and 3 bronze across the last 7 Paralympic Games. And so Tokyo next year now will hopefully be my 8th Games. And yeah, it's also next year coincides with my 30th anniversary as being on an international team, because my first team was the swim team. So yeah, I'll have been doing this 30 years by the end of next year.
I mean, it's just absolutely inspirational. You mentioned Tokyo, and of course, let's talk about that now, because we are all in extraordinary circumstances, but you have been training for that. As you say, that's been your absolute goal for the last 4 years. when that is moved, the goalposts are literally moved. How do you deal with it?
I think athletes have to be resilient and adaptable. And this is kind of that. This is this on an extreme scale. And we talk about one of the strengths of athletes of being able to prepare for a date that never moves. There's no extension like there might be if you have an illness before an exam. There's no deadline that can be moved if you're not quite ready. It's then or never. And this is the opposite of that. This has been moved a whole year. So it tests your character, it tests your ability to adapt, to bounce back. But it's not a life or death situation. It really isn't that important in the grand scheme of things, because the reason it's moved is a life or death situation. So you have to keep it into context. And having an extra year, that makes it different, more challenging, absolutely. But it's sport's just fantastic anyway. And we're all very excited for when sport can return, but it has to be at the right time when it's safe to do so.
And Sarah, just, I mean, I always hate to talk about age, but you're currently 42, so you'll be 43 next Olympics. I mean, for me, I think age, and we're seeing it more and more, you know, across the board, outside of competitive sport, inside competitive sport. Look at Jo Pavey, the runner as well, in her 40s, hoping to go to Tokyo as well next year. Do you think the age thing affects you at all? Or, you know, is it about recovery? Is it a psychological thing? Or do you feel every bit as good as you did 20 years ago?
I think the thing with age is comes that clarity, that mental capacity to cope with things in a different way. And especially when you've had two children like Jo has and I have, and other mums have, you learn that sport is a part of your life that you can segment away. You don't have to kind of obsess about it all of the time. And it is possible to do a lot of things on very little sleep, which you're never, ever told is possible when you're a young athlete. You're always told you've got to go to bed on time. You've got to get enough sleep. You've got to eat properly. You've got to put yourself first. Whereas when you're an athlete mum, you're not put first for the majority of the day. And the only time you are put first is that few hours of day, if you're lucky to get that length of time, when you're training. So I think that adaptability makes it better. It makes it, you're more resilient, and it makes you capable of kind of compartmentalizing the challenges into what is a genuine challenge. Because when you see a little person struggling to do something and you think, you know, that's way more important, you teach them to do that than, you know, you've had a bad day when you're out, you know, on a bike ride. So I think it puts so many things into perspective.
Do you know what? I don't think that's just a lesson for sport as well. I think also, you know, working mums, and there'll be lots of people listening to this who are working mums as well, or just whatever they're doing. And actually, being a mum does make you stronger in lots of different ways, and able, as you say, to sort of just, you know, I don't know, for example, when I was working, my children were very small. I had a different kind of focus.
Definitely. And I think you prioritize their development and their happiness over everything, because it's really important that when they're little and they're connecting their brain neurons as they're growing from being that tiny little helpless thing to learning to do things for themselves, that's what it's about, that you're creating a little person who's going to grow into their own person, and you're instilling the values of being a good person, being kind, understanding when other people need your help. And all of those things are way more important than a good training session. And you can do a good training session if you decide to do one, whereas a little person can't decide to do so many things for themselves because they're not ready yet. So for me, I think it just gives you that complete, you know, what is life or death? And bringing up a little person is, you know, just so important, and way more important than anything. And everything else then you can relax about, and you can perform far better because the pressure's off.
And Sarah, amazing. How important is it for you to get your children involved in sport? I mean, I have a background of triathlon, and I want my children to do stuff, but I don't feel that I'm that pushy about it. I'm fairly relaxed. I know yours are a bit younger. They're 6 and 2, is that right?
Yeah, Louise is 6. Charlie, we just celebrated his 2.5 birthday, because in lockdown, celebrating half birthdays is the new thing, we decided. We have a lot of birthdays between now and Louise's 7th birthday at the end of June, so we're just going full on with birthday cake for half birthdays as well. And both of them are very active children. They've been doing loads of little videos about how they like to stay active. They love riding their bikes. They love scootering. They've created a little kind of cyclocross style bike circuit around the outside of the house where they have to get up the steps at the front and down around the back. And they love it. And I think it's really important that they're fit and active, and they see activity as a just a normal part of life. So we always walk to school, where now we're always walking in the opposite direction into the countryside. And they just, it's just normal for them to be outside. And I think that's the thing that I want them to have as a way of life. That's what my parents gave me. And it was my own inspiration that took me into the elite sport world. And I very much hope that regardless of the fact they're hanging out at bike races, that they make the decision for themselves that if they want to be an elite athlete.
And I just think that's such an important message, isn't it, as well? I've tried really hard, and finally, after many, many years, it is paying off. But I just think if you can make it part of your lifestyle that, you know, doing exercise is not doing exercise, it's just what you do, that's where you make the difference.
It's definitely about lifestyle. And I think it depends on where you live, how easy that is, how much more effort you have to put in. So I think one of the things that's quite stark at the moment is there's no people sat in traffic jams going to ride a stationary bike at a gym. They're actually using their own bike and getting out and about. And I think, you know, we've built a world where we're very reliant on a motor car and a motor vehicle. And hopefully one of the very few silver linings that may come out of this horrific situation is that more people stay active and remain active beyond the health crisis, because activity really, it brightens your mood, it sets you up well for the day, and it just gives you so much from absolutely all angles, and it makes it just makes everybody feel better about themselves. And that's something that we've really had to focus on right now, so hopefully that will elevate it for everybody else and more people will incorporate it into their daily life.
And that's what I'm really struck by. So I see, because I live, I don't know if you can see behind me, you can probably see there's a, I'm very, very lucky, and I live right next to a river where, you know, there's a footpath, and there is, it has changed so much in the last 3 weeks. There are different people who I've, you know, because you get, you know, you do your walk or whatever it is, you get accustomed to seeing the same people, don't you? And there are people I've never seen there before, which is absolutely wonderful. Walking, running, cycling, whatever it is. And what I'm thinking is, okay, so they're doing that now. Have they not done it before? Or if they haven't, are they going to continue doing it? Because that would be an incredible thing to come out of what, where we are now.
I think so many more people are realizing how important it is to be healthy and to be fitter. And more people have kind of analyzed their own situation and had a look at how close they are to being in one of those vulnerable categories. So it's very easy to fall into that type 2 diabetes category if you're overweight, you've got high blood pressure, and you're on the verge of heart disease. And those people are people who can reverse that by being more active. And even if you're completely sedentary, a 10 to 15 minute walk a day will absolutely transform your life. And so the people who have the opportunity to reverse those potential underlying conditions are starting to analyse their own life and think, actually, I need to do something about this so that I'm not part of that category in this situation, in a future situation where it becomes vital. And so I really hope that that people find a way to continue that, because the pressures of work and of travelling to work and people live and you know, commuting time and all that, it means that the amount of time we have a day to do things just seems to be less and less and less.
Do you believe that people's attitude will change after and stay in place after the lockdown in terms of that commute, where it's possible to put in cycling and put in walking, you know, rather than getting a short bus ride or a train bus drive? You know, in fairness, that's not going to be possible for everyone, but how much do you think people's attitudes will change and stay that way?
I think attitudes will change to the amount of travel we have to do for work. So where you may have traveled great distances to meetings for an hour or so, people may continue to use you know, different online platforms to have those face-to-face meetings. And I know in a day when I'm traveling around in South Yorkshire to meet local authorities, I can go between Barnsley, Doncaster, Sheffield, Rotherham and meet four different groups of people, and it's taken me literally the whole day because I have to go between those, find somewhere to, if I can't do it by public transport because it takes even longer, and then you've got to find somewhere to park to then walk in. So there's so many different things that create a time consuming. So maybe if people start to use these online platforms more and more flexible working becomes more normal, then we see the types of journeys that we need to make change, and more people are then making journeys for leisure because they've had their 4 1-hour meetings from 8 till 12. They have an hour for lunch and they go out for a walk, and then in the afternoon they get on with some work, and that's their 2 or 3 days of a week, and then they spend the rest of the week in the office. And those types of changes are certainly things that people people are considering. And as we have to think about how this social distancing will continue until a vaccine is available, those may be the things that we come very, very used to. But leisure commuting and leisure, you know, journeys are so important. And in the work I'm doing in South Yorkshire to create an active travel network, we're putting as much emphasis on those leisure journeys as we are on commuter journeys, because we know people need to have confidence to ride a bike, and they're probably more likely to gain confidence in their leisure time.
There's so many things I want to say. And first of all, on Her Spirit, we've got this thing where every minute counts. We're all logging our minutes, which means we can then give away the app to people who can't afford it. So that's so important. And you're working really, working on that about sustainable transport as well, aren't you? That's something you're very passionate about.
Yeah, I started to work in everyday cycling with British Cycling and Chris Boardman when he was the policy advisor at British Cycling. And then he obviously works now as the Greater Manchester Walking and Cycling Commissioner. And then I, just over 12 months ago, took on the role of Active Travel Commissioner in Sheffield City Region. And I work with the Mayor, Dan Jarvis, over there to do pretty much the same role as Chris in Greater Manchester, to build an active travel network. And this is a targeted strategic plan that we still need to get funded, because funding into active travel has been very piecemeal. And we have a huge roads budget, but very little to support walking and cycling. But over the next 20 years, we want to build something that's comprehensive, that allows people to choose to leave their cars behind and to consider whether or not they need more than one vehicle in a house, if at all. And certainly I think this situation, for those people who are able to park their vehicles off the road, then they are, you know, furloughing those vehicles. Like, I've furloughed the vehicles I use for cycling races because I'm not going anywhere in them. My camper van that I would normally stay in before a race, I don't need it for the next 3 months. So I've got the tax back on it.
At Her Spirit, we know how powerful women can be. We love your strength, your determination, your compassion. We love the energy that sparks when we connect and spur each other on. Her Spirit was created to ignite that flame of determination, to unleash your energy, to build your self-belief, and to help every woman find a way to your healthiest mind, body, and soul yet. We want to inspire 1 million women just like you to be active, healthy and happy, because you deserve it. Head to herspirit.co.uk, join our core membership and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. Join our monthly challenges, get access to the Her Spirit Health Hub and track your activity levels, mood, food, sleep and stress every single week with your own personalised dashboard. Get expert advice and join daily live classes that can be played back at any time. Plus, find the support that you need to get started and stay motivated. Just sign up at herspirit.co.uk and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
I just look at the car outside and I can't even remember the last time I got in it. And the other thing, you're talking about meetings, and, you know, when Annie and I and Mel Berry decided to set up this podcast, we were like, okay, it's fine. And we found a little studio and that was absolutely brilliant. And then Annie and I went down there, and then Mark, our producer, went down there. And actually, and, you know, a week later, that was no longer possible. And if you told us that we would be doing this podcast very successfully on a meeting, on a virtual reality or whatever, through the internet, we wouldn't have believed it was true.
No, it's amazing how we can adapt as people to a situation. And I think, you know, everyone's finding different ways. And I think, you'll know from work that for the first 2 weeks, everything was focused on promoting and the messaging around the horrific situation we're in. Whereas this morning, I spent the best first half hour of switching the TV on watching Captain Tom.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned it.
And I'm just like, wow. And it's been one of those where, do I switch the telly on? Do I just check the stats on the internet? I know it's horrific, but we all need to focus on something that is a little bit positive, because the anxiety and that, you know, as well as flattening the curve, it's flattening people, and people are feeling just so, oh my goodness, I'm so helpless because I'm staying at home and I physically can't do anything else. And that feels like I'm not doing enough. So when you get to see these things that we're finally finding ways to promote, it's just amazing. And Captain Tom, it's just like, wow.
Did anyone else get really emotional watching
Yeah.
Because I started watching and I was just blubbering. I sort of couldn't look around at the kids because they always go, "Mom, you're really weird." But I just found I found it so emotional. You know, when you think the money that he has raised, you know, I mean, God, that guy's going to go on forever because this must have given him such an incredible boost. You know, because he's very, you spoke to him, didn't you, Louise? And he seems very with it still.
Well, it was just, I mean, it's been the most, I'm so glad you mentioned it because like you too, I was sitting there this morning trying to get ready for this podcast and completely mesmerized watching BBC Breakfast. You know, it sounds silly watching my own program, but I do watch it. And there he was completing his 100th lap of his garden. So it only started a week ago when they first spoke to him and he wanted to raise £1,000. But I think there's something so magical about, and you probably express this better, Sarah, than I will do, but about him, the fact that he was a war veteran, that he's going to be 100, and that we all have this outpouring of love and admiration for the NHS. And he has given us all somewhere where we can, you know, put our emotion and also put the cash. It's incredible.
It is, absolutely.
Louise, do you think he'll get a meeting with the Queen? He has to, doesn't he? I mean, he's not just going to get the average sort of like little birthday, 100th birthday card through the post from her, is he?
It's just marvellous. And I think he epitomises, you know, he's born at the end of the Spanish flu. So he's lived through the Second World War. He was there when the Queen was born and she, you know, became Queen. He's just seen everything. And it's just absolutely marvellous. And I've raced very close to where he lives in Bedfordshire. And so when I saw the name of where his house is, I was like, wow, you know, I know exactly where he is in the country. It's beautiful countryside around there. And I'm just so pleased that the weather has been great because this morning, that beautiful sort of sun coming up, it would not have been the same if it had been typical British weather.
Oh, just honestly, I'm quite emotional even talking about it, to be honest with you. And there is just something. What did he say? He said, you know, we'll be okay. The sun will come out again. The clerk. I mean, he's just nailed it, hasn't he, Annie?
Oh, he absolutely has. I just wondered, Sarah, if you were about to say you were going to become a stalker there and go down to his house and see if you could see him walking around his garden.
No, I'm not sure I'm allowed to ride that far at the moment. Oh. It'd be tempting.
It would be, wouldn't it?
That's something I wanted to pick up with you, actually, about cycling at the moment. So, because I'm pretty cautious in that I really do not want to cause any issues for the NHS, and I can fall off my bike when it's at a standstill. So I have been out, but I'm mostly inside. Sarah, what about you? Is it changing the way that you're riding?
It's changing the way I'm riding. I'm certainly taking far fewer risks. I was never a massive risk taker anyway because, you know, I know the kids need me. So me sliding off and having road rash is not a very good idea at the best of times. So I've always been a little bit cautious on open roads. And even though they're quieter now, one of the things that can be frustrating is when you do come across a hero who thinks they can descend faster and you think, just take it steady. There's no racing at the moment. You don't need to be that quick. But I think that, you know, there's lots of people out enjoying the weather and that's really important because, you know, being stuck inside, it must be horrific for those people that don't have the opportunity.
So Sarah, just going back, I guess around about 26, 27, how long have you been competing for Barcelona anyway, 1992? You were just 14. How can you imagine your little girl in 8 years' time, you know, standing at the blocks, you know, in that situation? You know, what advice would you give to her? And is it something that you want to encourage her to do?
Well, Louise is a fabulous little swimmer and she does enjoy it. She says that's the one thing she's missing about lockdown, not having that opportunity to go swimming. And she's actually taught at the moment by a lady who used to coach me, not planned at all, just that it happened that we were at the local baths and Judith was there. And Louisa was like, oh, do you know her? And I kind of told her the story that Judith coached me when I was about 10. And so Judith now teaches Louisa and she's on level 5. She wants to be on level 6 while she's still 6. But I'm not sure that's going to be possible, bless her. She's very driven. But I would give her the advice that you just have to enjoy what you're doing. And that's the thing that we do with both Louisa and Charlie is make sure what they're doing is enjoyable. And if they tell us, right, I've had enough, we don't try and persuade them to keep going at something. If it's an activity outside, we just let them choose to move on to the next thing. And I think that's one of the things that all kids are experiencing right now, because they're not in formal school, is that they get more chance to choose. And this sort of window of opportunity opportunity for them to have the choice again, where it's not led at the front of a classroom, is probably really good for their development, because they're getting that chance to develop their own ideas and be imaginative.
I like what you're saying there, because Annie, you spend a lot of time, I know, taking your children to various different classes, don't you? And I just think sometimes there is quite a lot of parental pressure which can put children off. And presumably, Annie, you see that. Sarah, you've seen that.
I think you're absolutely right, Louise. I don't know if you think the same, Sarah. I mean, it's just tempting, isn't it? Because there are so many activities for kids these days. And, you know, on one hand, you don't want your kids to miss out. But I think one thing that I found out during this lockdown, it's funny because Louise says you're doing lots of activities, because normally she phones me and she says, where are you now? Are you at the ice rink? Are you at the pool? Where are you now? Are you on the way to a piano lesson? And I just thought, maybe I need to just back off and slow down. I mean, I'm not mega pushy, but we do too much stuff, you know.
There is a lot of things, and everyone's worried that their child will miss out. Absolutely. You want to have the best for them. But I think sometimes I always look back at how many opportunities there were when I was little to do things. And there was, you know, there wasn't the social media, so you couldn't promote things quite so easily. So there wasn't an advert on Facebook. There wasn't an advert on Instagram. There wasn't somebody being able to promote something themselves. They had to get, a company to do it, and that cost money. So having that, there was a lot less. So we did a lot more as a family without having activities. So I think when Louisa is asked to go and do things, we've tried it. She did gymnastics for a little while, but then she found that she was lined up being told off more because other kids were messing around. So she stopped doing that. So then she wanted to do swimming lessons, and she's stuck at swimming and tennis. That's kind of her Monday, Tuesday activities after school. And then the rest of the week, she enjoys going to the library on a Thursday after school. And then the rest of the time, she chooses, and we go out for walks, we go out for bike rides, we visit Chatsworth, and we'll go to different places that she enjoys. There's a monkey place down in Staffordshire. She enjoys going there, different parks, and just places to build dens and just be kids outside. And I think that can be as vital. So this time in lockdown, you get a chance to see your kids' personalities close up a little bit more, and that can be really, really helpful.
Let's go back to you. Come on. So you talked about your parents encouraging you, but you sort of took that decision. When did you, 14 is so young to be standing on the start, like at a Paralympics. I mean, how did you get there?
So I first watched the Olympics in 84 as a six-year-old, and I just wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to pull on a GB tracksuit, walk into a stadium and compete for my country. And I wasn't really fussed which sport, but I was a good little swimmer. I'd fastest swimmer in my school by the time I was eight, and I was just really competitive. And swimming, I had a coach when I was 12 who had been an Olympian in the Deaflympics, and he knew how to access disability sport, and I didn't realize that disability sport existed until I was about 10, and he told me how to get involved. And in those days there was no emails, so I wrote a letter to the lady who was coordinating the Northwest Disability Swim Squad every time I did a personal best time in the pool. And I must have written a letter every week or so for about 18 months before I got a reply. I eventually got a reply in September of 1991 saying that there was going to be a swimming gala to choose the people going to the national championships the following February and the following June, because they had junior nationals, senior nationals. So 3 weeks later, I'm going to this competition, and I was by far and away the best swimmer there. It was a mixture of people who were there for therapy in swimming pools as much as it was for people who were competing. So it was a very massive cross range of people, and I really didn't feel very comfortable because I was put into a race with people who were much more disabled and had, you know, far more challenges. And I was like, why am I here? This isn't right. So there was then another lady at the competition who said, this isn't elite disability sport. This is a grassroots development opportunity. I'll send you to the national squad. That's next week in Fox Hollies in Birmingham. And if you go there, you can talk to the national squad. So my dad took me down there to Birmingham, and the following week I met up with people who are, you know, sort of household names in disability sport now. People like Paul Noble, who now does the commentary. People like Mark Woods, who does commentary. People like Chris Holmes and all these other people, friends of mine, Claire Cunningham, who works for Paralympics GB now. And this was where the elite squad was.
Exciting.
Well, yeah, it was incredible. And I, within the space of one session, I'd been put in the bottom lane, and I was in the top lane by the end of the session, leading the lane, making sure the boys went faster. And they they invited me to be part of the squad by the end of the weekend. So that was November. So the 18th of November, we worked it out because we were trying to work out the day that I was kind of accepted into an international squad. And that was the 18th of November, 1991.
Goodness me. Because I sort of gave up in some ways because I used to get so nervous. So you obviously were not, you just loved it. You embraced it.
I think nerves are all part of it. And I remember Tani Gray-Thompson talking to me about one of the things she wouldn't miss was the fact that she'd be physically sick with nerves before a race. And she would, you know, that was a part of the racing that she wasn't going to miss. And I've never been that nervous a person. I've always kind of been, oh gosh, will it work? But I've always been much more curious about what the outcome would be. So, you know, I'm willing to give it a go. And if it's not going to work and I don't win the race, that's fine. I'll come back and try it again. But the nerves have never kind of overwhelmed me. But everyone gets nervous, you're bound to. And I guess I was always fortunate that because I was training and competing with able-bodied swimmers from being very young, and I was always never good enough to beat them. My parents said to me, well, you just have to beat yourself. And that's the way that you improve. And I suppose I've kept that advice with me. So long as I'm being the best version of me, and that's a hashtag I use with our cycling team now, the best version of you is kind of the thing you can control. And that really is the driving force, even now at, you know, approaching eight games.
That is such brilliant advice. It really is, isn't it? In terms of like your career, when you look back, I mean, you've been so successful. How much would you put that success down to raw, pure talent? And how much would you put it down to, you know, your mental strength? And I guess, you know, you're just talking then how you deal with those nerves and stuff like that. You know, what would you sort of, if you had to break it to a percentage, you know, what of it, how much of it is mind and how much of it is body?
I think I've got a natural sort of genetics. I've got high hemoglobin. My mum's always had high hemoglobin. I tease her that she should have been an athlete because she's got really high hemoglobin for a female, and that tends to be good in sport because you can transport red oxygen with your red blood cells faster around your body or more effectively. So I've got some genetic, my physiology is good, and I'm generally don't get sick very often, which can be a challenge. And injuries, I think that, you know, the physio of our team will probably say I'm the person she sees the least. I tend to be quite robust. So I think those are sort of genetic qualities. But I've always been had this sort of hard work instilled into me from my parents. And I think working hard is absolutely vital, and then having a strong mindset. So there's sort of three parts to it, really. And if you're fortunate to have all three come together at the same time, then that can, you know, that's the ultimate, really. But I think on race day, it's, you know, it's almost all about your mindset, because everybody's done the same training. Everybody's kind of done the very best they can be to be in that physical condition on the day. So ultimately, it's about how you cope with those external factors that you can't control, that are nothing to do with your own performance. The only thing you should be focusing on is you. And a lot of people find that more difficult, I think.
This is a strange question to ask, but you then went on, we know you went from swimming to cycling, I mean, hugely successful, and then going on to beat as well able-bodied athletes. How significant is that?
I think the thing with cycling is that the technicalities of the sport and being able to handle your bike with all your brakes on one side, it required just hard work, and that kind of not fear of not falling off, I suppose, because if your brakes fail, you've not got another side to kind of save yourself with, as it were. So the technicalities of the sport were kind of more important. And I think it was a sort of a testament to the people who helped me overcome those technical challenges that we were able to get the, you know, succeed in events with able-bodied athletes. Physiologically, you know, when you put me on a static bike, I'm as good as anybody. Whereas in the swimming pool, having one less paddle was far more significant. But being able to overcome those technical challenges has allowed me to kind of progress further in the able-bodied peloton.
And just explain to me, is your bike specially adapted? Presumably it is.
Yeah, my bike's one that no one really wants to steal, because they'll try and pull the brakes on the left and they'll go into the wall. So all the brakes and the gears are operated from the right-hand side of the bars, which means that there are times when I have to choose between braking and changing gear, because I physically can't do all of the things at once.
Wow.
Sarah, just just to clarify why, I mean, obviously you were a hugely successful swimmer and then went over to cycling. Tell us what happened to make you go from swimming to cycling.
Well, I started cycling to cross train when I wasn't allowed to swim in 2005. I'd picked up an ear infection on a training camp in Australia. And when I got home, that ear infection just went ear, you know, three times in each ear over the course of about 6 or 7 months. And the doctors were quite concerned by the function of my ears failing effectively. So they told me I wasn't allowed to swim for an indefinite amount of time. And this was 3 weeks ahead of the cycling European Championships. And British Cycling had spotted me at the velodrome learning to ride the velodrome just as a part of my distraction from not being allowed to swim. And they selected me to a trial. And I almost beat the world record over 3K during the trial. So they asked me if I'd like to do some formal training. And 3 weeks later, they took me to the Europeans and I broke the world record.
Oh, wow.
So then I had to make a bit of a decision about whether I was going to go back to swimming or carry on with cycling. And I made a decision to switch eventually. It took a bit of time. So I was allowed to stay swimming for a few weeks once my ears got better. So I did one final swimming competition. I think it was end of October, early November in 2005, to kind of prove to myself that the decision was mine, not at my ears. So I went back to racing. I was very, very close to breaking the world record in the 100 meter freestyle when I raced that event. And so I kind of felt like I'd got back to the top in swimming and I was making the decision to switch on my terms. It was just that the ear infection had introduced me to this new sport.
Which is absolutely genius. And look at the success you've had. And Michelle, who is actually our cycling coach at Her Spirit, says, how have you navigated your career through what is a male-dominated sport, cycling? And even now, and I know things are changing, you know, it is very much male-dominated. And that's whether it's at the top level or out as we are on the road cycling with other people.
I think sport has been male dominated, even in swimming, where it's more equal in terms of opportunity at the top. I always found that I was training with more men than women. There was just more guys doing sport. And I remember, and it is kind of one of the tragedies over the last 30 years that we're still talking about, why we have such a big dropout rate of sort of 15, 16 year old girls, keeping them involved in sport in their later teenage years. And often they'll leave sport and come back to it in their late 20s or 30s or even 40s. And they don't see sport and competition as something that they want to continue with. And that's still a conundrum today, as it was in the 1980s, early 1990s. It's always been a challenge. So I feel like I've always been in a very male dominated world. And so I've got pretty thick skin. I've generally only ever had male coaches in the sort of elite end of my sporting career. So I don't really notice it perhaps as much, but I think it's really important we have those opportunities for the young girls to see that the sport is for everybody. It's not just for guys, it's for women, and that you can still be a girly girl and be an athlete. And that worry about sweating too much or not having, you know, time to put makeup on, or there's all these different things that girls consider to be a barrier. And we want to try and break that down and say that you can have times where you just kind of run like Phoebe from Friends, or, go to the pool and mess around, or enjoy sport for sport and activity. It doesn't have to be about elite competition. And I think that's the bit that the messaging that we need to get. And that's why This Girl Can is such a great campaign, because it talks about sport for sport, not because of competition.
And you know what, you're just talking about exactly why, you know, I'm here, I'm talking to you too, because I am that person who gave up age 15 at swimming. You know, I was good at it, not like you, but I could really swim. I was swimming in competitive sport and I gave up because I didn't like the way it made me look. And I just think, I'm appalled by my own behaviour, and I came back to it age 45. And it is still a conundrum, but yeah, I think, like you do, I think that if we can make it, and hopefully people listening to this, you know, it's step by step, it's part of your lifestyle, it's part of who you are, and you don't need to win. You do not need to win. For me, it's about enjoying it.
It is, and I also think we have to put PE back into schools in a way that's just far more visible than it is. You know, even down at primary school level now, you know, the amount of sport the kids get to do is probably 2/5 of what it was when I was at school. I remember doing sport every single day at primary school without fail. And my daughter does it on 2 days a week now. And the other days it's because of what we do at home as a family. And not everyone has that opportunity outside of school. So unless we can find a way to rebalance that in early childhood and make it a habit that is taken through childhood, it's like the habit of always, you know, walking to school rather than jumping in the car. Those kind of things are really, really important. And I think we do need to take a look at how we, you know, how we empower our children from being very young, because there's all sorts of talk about, you know, early years tests in maths and science and literacy. Well, actually, we need them to be the physical literacy of our children is far more important, in my view.
Oh my gosh, it totally is. I am so with you on that one. And I just think, you know, long term, it's very short-sighted to just be focusing in education, you know, so much on these tests that children are being put through at such a young age when the sport is being so ignored. And it's short-sighted because ultimately, you know, we will be overloading, you know, our health service with unfit, unhealthy children, you know, who have lifelong health problems if they don't do sport at an early age. And I just think it's one of those things that has to be done early. It has to be ingrained. And we're not talking from the pushy sense, but exactly as you're doing, Sarah, so brilliantly, and Louise now, but a little bit later with her kids, and me, is we're kind of instilling that sport can be fun, you know, and try the things that, you know, get rid of the things you don't like, but there is so much to do out there, you know.
I don't think it's interesting, Annie, you say that, because the thing is for me, what I read some, and Sarah, you may have seen that same research. I read some research which said that basically if you want your daughters particularly, I was concerned about, because that's what I've got, to do sport, the mum has to do sport, because if the dad does it, they'll just think, oh, it's just a dad thing. So that's what I've done. And it's taken, you know, my daughter's behind, she can't hear me actually. But the 18-year-old, as we talked before, Annie, I mean, she has embraced sport in a massive way. And I didn't push them because I just thought if I push, they're not going to do it because that's going to be really annoying. And actually, it has taken a long time. But this week, Annie, the little one, the 15-year-old, did 5K with me.
God, that is
because,
so
but
brilliant.
The interesting thing about that, there's a thing going on. I'm sure lots of you will have heard about it. They're all nominating each other to do 5K and give £5. But honestly, I'm so delighted. But Sarah, you know, so there's lots of things, you know, I didn't know that it was going to be her friends nominating her that would get her to do it. And hopefully she'll do it again.
I think it's so true. And you model the behaviour you want to see. So everything from the way that you talk about your own body, to the way you have your own relationship with food, to the things that you say about yourself, they have a massive impact on how your children view themselves. So a casual throwaway comment, oh, I feel fat in this outfit, it has a massive impact on a little person who's listening to that. And if you're getting out of the shower and you sort of like, oh, shake my wobbly bits, that's not a good idea, because a little person will then focus on, oh, I need to look at that myself. Is that a problem for me too? So it's about positivity and looking for the positives in things so that they have a healthy relationship with themselves and how they feel about themselves. And if they see you, I love this, when I'm all hot and sweaty at the end of a run, I feel so amazing. That's far better than saying, oh God, look at the state of me now. And those, that the words that we use are so, so vital. And I think it's really important that we do that and we look at sport. So one of the things that I kind of despair of is that we've introduced the Daily Mile at schools. Why can't we put that Daily Mile time into a structured lesson, into something, learning something like team sports or doing something with ball skills or something with, you know, genuine physical literacy with balance and the things, music and movement was something I did as a child. And so all of these things add up to a positive experience for a little person. Otherwise, they're thinking, oh, I've got to run 12 laps of the playground because I'm told I've got to do it. And that's not what we want. They'll never come back to running if that's the way that we present it to them.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because, you know, there's lots of mums out there are very busy, you know, and if it's got to happen at home because it's not happening at school, there you know, will be a debate there. It's like, how do I fit it in? And on that note, actually, Michelle Sharland, our cycling coach, asks you a question. How on earth do you juggle motherhood, training and running a team? So what top tips?
Let's not forget the team as well.
So my husband is an absolute superhero and a cape. He is an athlete himself. He competed in 2-3 Paralympic Games. in Athens, where I first met him, and then in Beijing and London. And, you know, he runs the house, looks after everything at home and keeps everything, all the balls in the air. So I'll go off to work in Sheffield or sit here and have the meetings online at the moment. And he's in the kitchen at the moment doing cookies with the kids. In term time, he's been doing the lessons, and I pop in and out as necessary. You know, he keeps the bikes in order and supports the girls on the team. And I run the social media, try and keep up with the website. And it really is a team effort. And then when we go away, we all go away together so that the kids are with us and they get to experience that. They learn a few language snippets along the way as well. But it's a team effort. It's not all me on my own.
One last question, because I've got a challenge for you coming up. Early warning, Sarah. You talked about food and your relationship with food. I mean, you know, you are a super athlete. I don't know, how many hours a day do you train?
It varies, anything up to 5 or 6.
Right, so it's a huge amount of volume. Presumably you can eat what you like. Would you describe yourself having a good relationship with food?
I have a good relationship with food now, but I didn't always have. I had an eating disorder as a 15-year-old. When I came back from my first games, I felt a huge pressure that I should be a skinny athlete, and I wasn't. I've always been powerful. And so I stopped eating breakfast. I used to skip lunch. I was having trouble with bullies at school as well, so I didn't need to go into the canteen to spend time with them. So I used to wander out of school at lunchtime and pretend to pick up something for my lunch, and then I'd pick up my tea. And I was still training, my swim training. I was training in the morning and the evening. I don't know physically how I was capable, but my running got better. I was a good cross-country runner, and I ran at English schools level. And as I got lighter and less muscle in my back from swimming, obviously, and in my butt, I became a much faster runner. And so my success in running kind of took off. And I was diagnosed with being having an eating disorder, but not anorexia. And the doctor, my GP, said, if you don't start to put some weight back on, then I will put you into the category of needing support from an eating disorder perspective in a hospital. And so that was kind of the thing that snapped me out of it. She said, I'll never forget, she said, you could do with a really good jam sandwich. because I was just, I had, you know, my body was, ketone levels were really, really high, and I was just wasting away. And I'd lost a significant amount of weight. I can't remember what it was now. I have got it recorded somewhere. I tend not to think about it. And I do have to sort of check myself sometimes, but I think I've got a much healthier relationship with food now. And it also allows me to try and spot it happening in other athletes, because there still is that kind of pressure on people. And we don't celebrate the variety of shapes of athletes enough, perhaps, as we should. We still have this kind of advertising where it looks like, you know, airbrushing and all that kind of thing. It still is a challenge, I think.
Gosh, I mean, you know, we're just coming to the end of the podcast, and I know you've got to go, and you've just opened up a whole nother lot of conversations there. And thank you for being so honest, because there'll be many people listening who will have been through things like that. But on the upside, you know the signs in yourself, and you know the signs in others.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that it's the ultimate control thing, you know, being able to control what you're eating and looking at numbers on a scales. It can become very kind of like, you know, focused. And I think there'll be people who think that's the only thing they feel like they can control. In sport, there's lots and lots of things you can't control. And that's one of the few things that you can. And it can become...
Which is dangerous, isn't it?
And it become obsessive. So we have to control our mindset as well and know what's healthy. And I always say, you're better off trying to produce more power than trying to lose more weight. Because if you produce more power, then your power to weight ratio still goes up, because you're still producing more power. And that's the positive way to look at it.
Right. I know it's on countdown. You've got one more minute. So the challenge, I don't know if anybody's told you this. In fact, it's very new. So the BBC is doing this thing called the Big Night In to raise money for charities for people who are affected by coronavirus, etc. So I'm planning to do the Big Bike In. Okay, I'm going to do 100 miles on my turbo trainer at home. And basically, please, would you join me for a little bit?
I'm sure I can. Send me some time.
It's 5 o'clock next Thursday evening. You know, 10 minutes. I mean, obviously in 10 minutes, you'll probably do the 100 miles. I know you won't. But it would be just really lovely if any support, even a tweet, whatever, it would be just lovely.
Fantastic. That's amazing. I'm looking forward to seeing you do that.
Oh, yeah, I'd love that. Seeing me do that.
I'm not doing the whole 100 miles. That's absolutely That's 100 miles on a turbo is a bit wow.
it's potentially really boring, isn't it?
I think you'll need a good pair of shorts.
Annie's supposedly joining me.
We need to talk about this because I haven't been on a bike for about 15 years. But, you know, I love a good challenge. So, you know, and as I said to you last week, just use a sponge. Lots of like kitchen thick sponges down your shorts, Louise, or on the saddle. You'll be fine.
And just one last thing, Sarah, before you go. I know you've been such a great guest. Thank you very much. If anybody's listening to this and they still feel sort of intimidated or worried about going out for a run or whatever it is, what's your sort of sweet short message for them?
Give it a go. Find a quiet time of day and just give it a go. Because even if it's just for 10 minutes, you'll feel better and more confident and hopefully do it for longer next time.
Brilliant. And thank you so much for being a guest. And thank you to Annie as well for ignoring my husband who's been making cups of tea, the dog, the daughter, whatever it is. You've been brilliant. I apologise.
Thanks,
thank
Sarah.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Sarah.
Epic story. You're absolutely incredible. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gosh, Annie, there was so much in that conversation, which really took me by surprise, actually.
There was a whole lot of stuff there, really, honestly. I mean, just some amazing advice, you know, and just hearing about her incredible career, you know, the highs and the lows. There's obviously been a lot more highs, but there's been a few lows too. But, you know, what stands out for me about Sarah is just, you know, her strength of character, you know, as a human being. She kind of rolls with the punches and, you know, she doesn't let anything get her down. She's a great mum, you know, and a phenomenal athlete.
And brilliantly down to earth. She still stays in her camper van when she's going to major races.
Oh my God, I can't imagine in my years, which obviously were a few years ago, you know, staying in a camper van. I mean, I love camper vanning with Tim and the kids and stuff. You know, that's great
you
fun.
You do, but, don't you?
Yeah, but I love a bit of that. But, you know, with a few glasses of wine and not worrying about the fact that I'm going to get about 4 hours sleep. I don't think I'd have been doing it before the races, but that's what she's got. You know, she's absolutely salt of the earth, isn't she?
What's your favourite thing? What's your kind of like, you know, special thing when you go in a camper van that you have to have?
Wine.
I should have guessed that, shouldn't I?
Oh my God, it's terrible. The worst thing is you have a terrible night's sleep and you wake up with a hangover. But that makes it sound like I don't enjoy it. I do. I love being with the kids.
Do you all sleep in the van?
Yeah, we do. We've got a two up, two down kind of thing. So yeah.
Honestly, if I could do my life again, I mean, I've threatened so many times to my family that I'm going to get a camper van. They're like, please don't. And I never have. And I kind of feel like I'm missing out.
Oh, it's so much fun. Honestly, it really is. I can't say I'd want to do them more than about three nights or so, but you know, we kind of drive down to Devon and, you know, the kids and Tim go for a surf. You know me, I'm a tri baby, aren't I, as lovely Kate Botley called me. And I find it a bit chilly down there in Devon to get out in the water, but no, you've got to do it. It's never too late, honestly. That's always my motto, Louise, and as you've seen from yourself and what you've achieved over the last 5 years in triathlon, it's never too late. Get yourself a camper van, girl.
I could always just borrow yours, Annie.
Actually, do you know what? I mean, I know Tim is very fond of you, but I'm not sure if he's lending his camper van to you. I mean, he frowns and I can see him getting all antsy when I say, oh, do you mind if I take the van today, darling? He gets all twitchy. He doesn't like it.
I can imagine. Oh, it's his pride and joy. So just really briefly, so this Thursday, the 23rd, I'm going to do this. Going to do this bike ride 100 miles in support of the BBC's Big Night In. I'm really pleased with my title, The Big Bike In. And basically anybody can join in. They don't have to join, you know, they can join me through the Her Spirit. They can join me wherever they like. They can join me on Twitter. I just want company for 1 minute, 5 minutes, whatever it is. If somebody wants to do it, Mel Berry is going to do 100 miles with me, aren't you? She's listening. She's smiling.
Wow.
She's not going to be smiling after 100 miles.
I mean,
can all join in together, can't we, in some form or the other?
Well, yeah, I know you've been trying to encourage me. And, I feel that if I could get the equipment, I will be with you. And once I start, you know, I'd have to do 100 miles. But it's all down to whether I can find the equipment. And just bearing in mind, I haven't been on a bike for about 15 years. So,
okay, well, you could do like an Instagram live with me drinking wine while I'm cycling. Is that going to get you off the hook, isn't it?
it could do definitely. How's your training going for it? Are you doing any particular training or not?
No, I'm not. I was on the bike yesterday. I'll probably do a couple of hours on it tomorrow. I mean, you know, it's fine. It's just going to be a little bit painful, but it's fine. So we will, on the Her Spirit app, we will let everybody know how they can join in. We're hopefully going to have like a Zoom meeting as well, so you can see me in full sweatiness, etc. And it should be really fun. I just want all I want people to do, we'll try and raise
a bit of money as well, because we're going to have a team money raising page, is have fun, do something together. Thank you so much for listening today, everyone. If you've missed out on earlier episodes, we have had some brilliant conversations. So please go back through our catalogue. And thank you as well, especially for all your ratings and reviews. And a special thanks to Alison, who's left a 5-star review. Thank you, Alison. And she says, great, inspiring, friendly podcast. So grateful I have these to listen to and keep me motivated. So thank you, Alison. Thank you to everybody else who's listening. Tell your friends. And if you want to get first news of when we release our next podcast, then please subscribe. Thank you very much, everybody. Goodbye.
Hi, my name's Mel Burry and I'm the co-founder of Her Spirit. Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast, and we hope you found it useful. I'd just like to say thanks to our sponsors, Medichecks, who without their support, this wouldn't have been possible. Medichecks offers simple to use blood tests. Wanting to strengthen your immunity or check for underlying conditions, they offer a home test with doctors' reviewed results. Just go to medichecks.com to find out more. And remember, together we've got this. Have a great day.